From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. By now you've seen the body cam video of University Hospital nurse Alex Wubbles being dragged outside of the emergency room by Salt Lake City Police Detective Jeff Payne. He pushed her up against a wall and handcuffed her. Payne wanted to draw some blood from an unconscious patient. Wubbles wouldn't let him. It was against the hospital policy. You've seen the video. Everyone has seen it at this point. It went viral and sparked outrage and condemnations around the country. Today in the program, we're talking about what happened. Not the legal questions or the procedural ones, but why Detective Payne acted the way he did. Our guests today say this wasn't just one officer overreacting, that this kind of thing happens all the time when the public questions the authority of the police. There also may be a biological part to this. As one guest puts it, an addiction to anger. Salt Lake City Police Chief Mike Brown will also join us today after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you've seen that body cam video of University Hospital nurse Alex Wubbles being pushed through the doors of the emergency room, her arms being pulled behind her and where she's handcuffed, she's screaming, calling for help. You know how gut-wrenching it was. By now, you know the story behind it. Wubbles would not give Salt Lake City Police Detective Jeff Payne access to an unconscious patient. He wanted to draw some blood, but the policy at the hospital wouldn't allow it. So she told him no. She got a hospital administrator on a cell phone. They went back and forth. But at that one moment that plays out here, Officer Payne had had enough.
She's the one that has told me no.
Yeah, but sir, you're making a huge mistake right now. Okay. Like you're making a huge mistake because you're threatening a nurse.
Okay. No, we're done. We're done. You're under arrest. We're going. We're done.
Now, what happened? Our guests today say this wasn't just one officer didn't quite know the law and decided not to respect a policy, that this was about something larger. Officer Payne, they say, is part of a law enforcement system fueled by authority and power, and that in that interaction with the public, when someone challenges that authority, they say in that moment an existential question is raised. One of our guests says officers often think they're the living emblem of authority. So what happened at the University Hospital? This is also about brain chemistry, the way men, I'm afraid it's often men, react to situations like this. That's what we're talking about today, asking what happened with Eric Young. He's an assistant professor of media studies at Dixie State University in St. George, also a partner and facilitator with Guardian Tactics. It's a consulting firm that teaches de-escalation tactics in law enforcement and other settings. And I should also mention he's my brother-in-law. In fact, a conversation with him got me thinking about all of this. And Eric, welcome to you.
Thanks, Doug. Good to be here.
Norm Stamper is also joining us. He was a cop for 34 years, former chief of the Seattle Police Department. He writes now on policing and police reform. His latest book is called To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. He's joining us today by phone from his home in the San Juan Islands in Washington. And Norm Stamper, welcome to you.
Thanks very much. Good to be with you.
I want to begin with Norm Stamper, if you would. We'll get to some particulars as we go, but would you give me a sense of what you're seeing in that clip that we just played? When you've seen, clearly you've seen the video at this point. What are you seeing? What's going on as you see it?
What I'm seeing is an individual whose authority has been challenged. And who reacts very badly to that. I wish I could say that it was shocking, that this is an anomaly and very, very unusual, when in fact it's all too typical. A police officer who embodies authority, who is convinced that any challenge to his official authority is really a personal challenge. And they take it personally, and they wind up doing the kinds of things that this officer did.
Yeah. Eric Young, this idea of taking it personally, is that an important part of this?
Yeah, it is, because once the ego is offended that way, and it goes beyond the authority goes through and puts that narcissistic kind of ego presence in their mind. And so once the offense happens, and this is kind of exacerbated, you hear it in the clip that this has happened over and over again, and this always goes on while I'm trying to do my job, and that kind of always or never kind of thinking ends up igniting then that taking it personally. And from that point, it starts to ramp up. He has this argument in his head. That
it escalates.
Yeah, it does, until the serotonin dump hits, and then he fires off.
Is this a new phenomenon, Norm Stamper? I mean, I've heard it said that you've got militarization going on, and you've got popular culture, and it's different or it's worse. You're not so sure it's really anything new.
It is definitely not anything new. As a matter of fact, I think what is new is that average white middle-class Americans are now seeing what they've only heard about in the past. From an official spokesperson behind a lectern and a bank of microphones, we'll get an explanation about a controversial shooting or an incident like this. But we don't see what actually happens. We don't hear what actually happens in those kind of sterile press conferences. And so I think what's new today is exposure. And it's about time. I think this is vital for improving the institution, improving personally the safety of individual officers who, when they do learn, as your other guest has pointed out, how to recognize the gift that their body is giving them when their heart races, when they begin to act impulsively, if they've been well trained, if they understand the dynamics of fear and anger and other emotions in their bodies, then they're in a position to actually do something to de-escalate themselves before they attempt to de-escalate a tense situation.
Not only is it not new in that respect, it's actually celebrated in our culture. We have athletic competitions where when a fight breaks out in an NBA game, we're cheering it on, or in a hockey game or something, or just by the very nature of the structure of play in football follows along the same type of line in terms of escalation and then apex and then blowing it off and coming back and doing it over again. So it's not just germane to law enforcement and the male ego.
That's a good point.
This is across the board in terms of male behavior.
This kind of escalation happens all the time.
We love it.
And we love it.
We do.
Eric Young, you've said that this is about, in some ways, this is about brain chemistry. And there's a kind of, this is how you put it to me, a kind of addiction to anger. What do you mean by that?
Well, the serotonin levels start to peak once the ego can't find some type of way to placate itself. And this cognitive dissonance is going on. We're looking for a way to make it right. So for Detective Payne, his way to make it right is to eliminate the barrier of the nurse not allowing him to do the blood draw.
So let's talk about that moment that's playing out in the emergency room. This is in the moments before he says we're done here. What are you seeing in that video?
So his endocrine system lights up. His limbic system lights up. Adrenaline is pumping at this point. We hear that in his speech patterns, his paralinguistics. He gets into semantic aphasia where he's not making any sense verbally anymore. He engages.
His voice kind of quivers a
bit. It does. Not just kind of. He's all over the place. Way in high registers. And that's evident before he says, okay, that's it, and we hit that trigger. But then when he moves her outside and gets her to the position where he's handcuffing her, that's when the serotonin hits. And that flood of serotonin, that's a reward system. And what's going on is it's amplifying the synaptic responses neurologically, right? And it's the same response that a male feels when he has an orgasm. We like that feeling. So for that to become addictive, men understand that if they blow off, if they throw that wrench down onto the bench, or if they throw the punch or whatever the case might be, right after that they get this this feeling, this release, and you can see it in his face.
In Detective Payne's face.
Yeah, you can.
Norm Stamper, what do you think about that? If there's such a powerful biological thing going on, that's hard to overcome, it seems.
it's very hard to overcome in the absence of you know, a competent selection process that helps us determine who should be cops in the first place, mm-hmm. and entry-level education and training of the type that actually acquaints individuals who 5 minutes ago weren't cops at all, weren't exercising this extraordinary authority, and who are then given the opportunity, if the training is well designed, if the policies and the procedures, the tactics and practices are all supported by the culture. But as pointed out, the culture rewards the kind of behavior that we all witnessed. So that has to change. The structure and the culture of policing, I'm convinced, has to change. We can't keep putting body cameras on officers or adding new de-escalation training without recognition that culture rules. And if the culture is reinforcing that behavior, guess what? That's the kind of behavior we're going to see.
What's the difference between power and authority, Norm Stamper? We think of them as the same kind of thing. You see a distinction.
I definitely see a distinction, and it's not just semantics. Authority is the sanctioned right to order the actions of other people. This hospital had the authority to set a policy, and from what I gathered from the footage, actually secured an agreement with local law enforcement to follow that policy. So the nurse is basically saying, you can't do this because you don't have the authority to do that. Well, I'm convinced that power generally trumps authority in every instance. It really does flow from the culture. So if you've got a police officer whose authority is being challenged, he's more likely than not to respond with something like, look, we're the cops and you're not. We're in the driver's seat. We make these decisions. I've made the decision. We're done here. And then we saw what happened.
Yeah, Lieutenant Tracy illustrates this pretty...
I mentioned what you mean, Lieutenant James Tracy.
So he's the supervisor who shows up on the scene towards the latter end of the clip, and he's trying to engage Nurse Webbles, and he indicates to her, he says, you got in the way of my law.
Let's play that moment. We actually have
this. Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah,
right.
Let's play this moment, because that may underline what your point here.
Okay, and your policy right now is contravening what I need legally, okay? Which I may not need it. If you have blood that I can get Logan to come and get a warrant and test for later, okay? But this is all stuff that we should have a conversation with before I'm told no, 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 okay? There's a very bad habit up here of your policy interfering with my law, okay? I am trying to conduct a criminal investigation, step through the process. Okay? And you guys are trying to prevent liability coming on the hospital. And I appreciate that, but those sometimes don't meet, and they don't match up. And so I gotta decide what we're going to do with this young lady.
If you didn't hear, he says, I've got to decide what we're going to do with this young lady.
This young lady. Yeah. That's another...
kind of a dismissive way,
yes,
of putting
absolutely.
It. Yeah. All right. Yeah. We can talk about that one later. Right. But what are you hearing about the my law? What is he saying there?
Well, that it's not the law. It's not the definitive law. It's not the people's law. It's that we're interfering with his power, not his authority.
Norm Stamper, isn't in when he says my law also him saying we're not – our interests aren't together. I've got my thing, my law that I need to deal with, and you've got – and all you are doing, as he's saying in this clip, is protecting – you know, covering your ass basically. You're protecting the liability of the university.
Absolutely. And I think I mentioned earlier, it would be wonderful if this were an anomaly, that we rarely see such dramas unfold. But in point of fact, when you challenge a police officer's authority, his law, you're making it very clear that there's no partnership there. The police in America, not to get too philosophical here, it's the fundamental premise that the police in America belong to the people, not the other way around. Yeah. So this police officer talking about his law is sending a very strong message. We are in charge here. We aren't. I may be in your on your turf. I may be, you know, within the confines of a hospital environment that's guided by policies and procedures that you've all signed off on. But guess what? My authority supersedes anything and everything that's going on here. We've had some really horrific examples of police officers intervening in medical situations, not just a blood draw, but where doctors are attempting to provide treatment, and they've decided that their law trumps medicine.
I wonder if when you see the conflicts going on in Ferguson, for example, now that did not involve did not take place on a medical campus. But I wonder I know there's a racial component. Of course, I'm not going to say there's not a racial component. In fact, that's not at all what I'm saying. But is this as about authority as well as race, I suppose? Norm Stamper?
I certainly do believe that it is. Race is a factor, and we certainly can't ignore it. It wasn't a factor in this particular situation. But my belief is that white police officers, not all certainly, but far too many, are afraid of black men. Young black men, the bigger, the darker the black men, the greater the fear. And officers resort to an abuse of their power as well as their authority when they do the kinds of things that Darren Wilson did mm-hmm. with Michael Brown. But yes, it's true that Michael Brown, using an expletive, told the officer what he could do with his order to get out of the street. The officer took personal offense at that, had already driven by the way, and then drove back in a very reckless, high-speed manner and trapped Michael Brown right next to his own car door, and then complained that Brown had trapped him. So what we have is a situation in which any questioning of that authority is going to trigger the kind of reaction that we saw in that hospital.
Yeah, just trigger the word.
Triggers the word there, certainly, between Michael Brown and the officer, what had happened there. And actually, the officer, it's reported that he actually hit him with his vehicle when he was reversing that way, which certainly went through and escalated the situation. But in terms of what we're talking about with Nurse Wobbles and the detective Payne, you know, we're into a different ism there, and it's sexism. He doesn't recognize her authority there at all, just by virtue of her being a female. And, in fact, talks down to her in terms of calling her little lady. And then we hear the same vernacular come out with the lieutenant when he shows up and treats her the same way. So there's some misogyny going on here. And, again, this isn't anything new, certainly.
In that sense, is this a male thing?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
In terms of the reaction that men, you think,
well,
behave differently?
It's the perfect storm of ego, power, authority coming together, and then you have that serotonin spike in terms of the anger addiction, and then you have not a great perception of women on top of that. It all comes together and ends up with a woman getting her arms put up in the small of her back with a handcuff that way.
Norm Stamper.
Policing has always been a male-dominated culture. And if you look at patterns of misbehavior, patterns of misconduct, you will see those threads of misogyny and sexism very, very frequently. What's needed, I'm convinced, is an infusion of far more women into that culture and the kind of education and training that sends two messages. One is, if you've always behaved this way and it's counterproductive or it's harmful to society, to your reputation of your organization, then you need to get acquainted with some new behaviors and to really absorb the messages behind those behaviors. And if you can't or you won't, we don't have a place for you here. There is absolutely no place for any brand of bigotry, including misogyny.
We're going to talk about some of those solutions, how you deal with this, how you de-escalate. Not de-escalate on the part of the subject, which is an important point here, but the officer in this case, himself. Eric Young is with us, teaches media studies at Dixie State University, facilitates de-escalation training for law enforcement, and we have Norm Stamper with us, the author of the book, To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what happened in July at the University Hospital when Detective Salt Lake City Police Detective Jeff Payne arrested, handcuffed, Nurse Alex Wubble. The questions we're talking about aren't the legal ones, but why Detective Payne acted the way he did. It's a conversation about how American law enforcement thinks about authority and power. There's also some human nature thrown in here as well. We have Eric Young with us, an assistant professor of media studies at Dixie State University. We also have Norm Stamper with us, who was a police officer for more than 30 years, former chief of the Seattle Police Department. He's written a book. Well, he's written a number of things, actually, on police reform. His latest book is called To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. He's joining us from his home on the San Juan Islands in Washington. I wanted to maybe throw in, and Eric Young, you can mention something about this, that we're not talking about all cops. It's a disclaimer we should mention.
It's real easy for us to go through and take that kind of stereotype and apply it pretty broadly, but that's not the case, certainly. I've worked with outstanding officers. I have two partners involved with Guardian Tactics who are former law enforcement who also understand these practices that Norm Stamper's talking about. And my son is in law enforcement. Mm-hmm. He's a deputy sheriff that way. So certainly this doesn't apply across the board. I just wanted to make sure that we understand that.
Speaking of your son, how old was he when he went into the police academy?
He was, 22 when he went into the academy.
And what was the condition of the way his brain was developing at that age?
Well, that's a great question because one of the issues in terms of police academies and the youth of the recruits coming in is they're dealing with frontal lobes that aren't fully developed. And that frontal lobe is where they get into that critical ability to talk themselves down. And that full development in most males doesn't happen until about the age of 29. So we're dealing with recruits who don't have the ability really to detach themselves, recognize their behavior, and then find ways critically to go through and intrinsically de-escalate themselves, at least according to the brain research that's out there.
Norm Stamper, you've talked about that there's an historic mistrust with police and on some level, and we're kind of doomed from the start because you've got these young recruits who are not trained in, I guess, in the to understand what's going on, as you said earlier, with their brains and their bodies.
Yeah, I that's absolutely true. At one point some years back, the Houston Police Department decided it wanted to hire 18-year-olds. And my reaction at the time was, my God, do you realize what you've just taken on? And huge problems ensued, and they quickly abandoned that policy. They were having trouble recruiting. So, you know, rather than fill a vacancy with somebody you know is going to be a liability, you just go with a vacancy. You know, speaking as a police administrator, you don't want to take on you're not there to raise 18-year-olds. You are there to supervise and help lead them down paths that will help them to become, exemplary police officers. But the system works against that. It truly does. It's paramilitary. It's bureaucratic. It's top down. It is inimical to the interests of a true partnership between community and police. You know, I think about a partnership. I think about a detective and a nurse, for example, who are facing a quandary. And the question is, how are we going to resolve this? If you believe you're talking with a partner rather than some subordinate who is enjoying that status, I use that term lightly, because of her gender or because of her occupation or both, you wind up in a situation in which the inequality that is essential for a true partnership is completely absent. And that was the case during this incident.
Eric Young, your son had how much firearm training compared to the other type of training that talks to him about the way he reacts to people?
Yeah, the ratio was alarming enough for me to take notice there. I try to keep tabs on his academic training that's going on there versus his self-defense and firearm training. And it's pretty out of whack. I don't recall the numbers specifically, but it was 60 to 65 hours in terms of firearms training and maybe 3 or 4 hours in terms of interpersonal training. And even the interpersonal training was tantamount to what's called verbal judo, which also kind of is the placebo in terms of engaging somebody. It's, or getting into ask, tell, make, a popular law enforcement philosophy in terms of how you verbally engage somebody. You ask them. If they don't comply, you tell them. If they don't comply, then you get into coercion of some type of physical force that way. And for them, that seems to be enough in terms of that kind of training, and it's obviously not.
When police departments generally speak about de-escalation. Mayor Buskupski, for example, said, we've got a process of de-escalation. But what is she talking about? Because it's different from what you have in mind.
Right. So she's talking external de-escalation. She's talking about subject de-escalation, which is critical as well. But no police officer, nobody, regardless of their position, can go through and de-escalate somebody else if they are escalating at the same time. So the mirror needs to be held up to law enforcement to understand what's happening psychologically and physiologically as their own buttons are being pushed within a situation, and how to go through and thwart that from happening and remain cool-headed enough to make the critical decisions that are your stewardship.
How do you fix this, do you think, Norm Stamper? We can go through some of the techniques you mention or some of the suggestions you mention in your book, but generally speaking, what do you do about this?
Generally speaking, I think the first order of business is to ensure that every single police officer understands that he or she is engaged in a partnership with the community. And I don't use that word partnership in any kind of cosmetic or PR sense, but rather one in which one partner wouldn't think under, less than exigent circumstances, would not think about acting unilaterally or arbitrarily. Partners don't do that to one another. So let's assume that this cop and this nurse have entered this interaction from the perspective of a partnership. Okay, we've got a policy that says we can't do this. I've got a need that says this individual that from whom I want to draw blood and who happens to be unconscious was involved or may have been involved in some very serious criminal activity. So there are two needs that are clashing. Mm-hmm. What sounds like had been in place was an agreement between the hospital and the police. And if that's in fact true and these officers were not aware of that agreement or chose to violate it, which clearly they did, we have a foundational problem. And it comes down to perspective. You and I are in this business together. Public safety, protection of civil liberties, officer safety is a joint responsibility, community and police. So in my book, I do suggest ways that we can structure that partnership that will make it more consistent with a free and democratic society.
You say in the book that citizens should be involved in all aspects of police operations, in policymaking, in the development of these programs, in police oversight, in the use of lethal force review panels, so citizens directly engaged in these processes.
Yes. I think it's essential that citizens be involved in policymaking and program development, setting priorities. They are the ones who are the recipients of police services. And short of those situations where you're dealing with an active shooter or you have a blatantly dangerous situation, citizens and police officers need to be working seamlessly in the interests of public safety and neighborhood health and the protection and preservation of human life and an honoring of civil liberties. That's at the heart of what cops are here to do. And to this point, they've done it alone. Mm. They've done it in opposition to the very people they've been hired to protect and serve. And it ain't their fault. I mean, this is the way it's been for decades. Police officers do generally what they've been trained to do, whether it's in a classroom or in the front seat of a police car or in the locker room. They've been trained to do what they do. And we need to reverse so much of what passes for police training these days.
Eric Young, we don't have a lot of time to go through some of the de-escalation techniques that you use, but maybe pick a few. Give me a sense of what is it you do. You've talked about, for example, recognizing the context of what's happening, that
right.
The officer needs to recognize the context and try and sort of tamp down their own, be aware of, I suppose, and tamp down their emotional chemical reaction.
Well, they
got
to go back to the purpose of their duty, the reason why they're serving, and that comes into a social, cultural, and a psychological context. And in my training, we kind of teach this basic contextual analysis of what's going on to where it becomes a second nature to them. But even more important than that is the officer's ability to do what's called, I call bifurcation, that they're able to recognize how they are coming off in terms of their tonality, in terms of their posture, their presence. They've already changed this situation by showing up in a cruiser and then showing up with with a uniform, a badge, a vest, a gun, all that's going on. So they've already heightened the situation just by their presence. And so there needs to be more awareness of how can they maybe pull that back a little bit in their demeanor, in how they're speaking with the individuals involved. So, and not just in terms of their voice, but what's their face expressing? We saw an officer step in and try to bring the detective back, and that's secondary to this as well, is the partner, the backup, has the ability to go through and recognize when the primary officer is escalating that they're able to go through and tag out and then pick up.
Yeah. Say, dude, relax.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, not necessarily calling him out in front of the subject
I see.
But to step forward and let him go back and relax and then engage at that point.
We're running out of time. I do want to get you on this question. Norm Stamper, and you too, Eric Young. Should Detective Payne be fired? Should this be a criminal investigation?
I personally don't think it should be a criminal investigation. I think we hear oftentimes this is a learning moment, and indeed it is. The whole world watched what happened at that hospital. I am sure that this officer is feeling aggrieved and humiliated and not altogether happy with the attention that he's getting. But he becomes, I think, sort of a lightning rod. And I think it's important that we recognize the value of systematically breaking down the policies, the procedures, the education, the training, the culture of law enforcement. And instead of just fixating on the incident, recognize that this is going to happen again and again and again unless we make those major changes.
Yeah, I agree. He needs to be removed, though, from the context of his duties until he's able to go through and have the adequate training. And obviously,
sure.
That's what I'm going to say because that's what I do. But that needs to happen to where we can trust his ability to do his stewardship.
It's Eric Young. He teaches media studies at Dixie State University, facilitates de-escalation training for Guardian Tactics, a consulting firm. Thanks very much.
You bet. My pleasure.
For joining us. And Norm Stamper, he's the author of the book To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police, joined us from his home in the San Juan Islands. Norm Stamper, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Salt Lake City Police Chief Mike Brown will join us. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about what it is that happened in July at the University Hospital between Salt Lake City Police Detective Jeff Payne and Nurse Alex Wubbles. Joining us now on the program is Chief Mike Brown. Served in the Salt Lake City Police Department since 1991. He's headed the department first as interim and now as chief of police for some 2 years now. And Chief, thanks for coming in. Good morning.
Thank you, Doug. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk with your listeners.
When you look at that tape, as I'm sure you've done multiple times at this point, and I'm talking about that moment when the detective says, we're done here.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see that's going on at that moment?
First off, I've seen the video maybe once.
Is that right?
Yeah. I've tried to keep myself a little bit distant from this the whole process because what we need – you need to understand there is a due process. Officers have a protected right to their job. We have an MOU and a contract through the labor union, and so we have to look at – we have to follow the process. In this process, or at the end, I have to make the final decision. Right. So I don't want to influence it, steer it, or prejudice anything that I see. So I have seen it. I was alarmed, Doug. I was alarmed. It concerned me very much. I saw a breakdown in communication that I just don't think had to happen.
Do you think that there is the proper kind of training in place for officers to recognize when they start feeling that surge of emotion, when they're angry because someone is not doing what they – look, and he was told by another officer, go get that blood draw. You've got to do this.
Yeah,
Why is she not reacting? I think – I know the policy, but I still need – and it just amps up and amps up. Is there a – do you have things in the works, training in the works that helps them deal with
that?
Yes,
we do. I mean, we put our officers through our own academy. Salt Lake City has the right through the state to have an accredited academy. So we do things a little bit different. We still check off on all the requirements of the state, but we get to kind of put our own spin on things. And I heard your guest earlier talk about the discrepancy about firearms training and then interpersonal skills training.
Mm-hmm.
I have looked at that. And about a year ago, I reported back to the city council that we have flipped that. Our firearms has stayed. We want to be proficient in what we do.
Yeah.
But 99% of the time when we go on a call, it's that interpersonal skills that we need. And so we've trained very hard on those topics.
I'm not sure how much you can say about this. Some of these questions were contingent upon a sort of reaction that you may not be able to make. So let me ask it anyway. What is Detective Payne saying about all of this? How does he explain what happened up there?
That is part of the process, Doug.
Okay.
I mean, he's been interviewed, and he'll be able to have his say reviewed in that process.
Our guests today have talked about, and I want to get your sense of this, that there's something really complicated going on. This is not just one officer who forgot his training, that there is – it's kind of a – there's a brain chemistry at play, there's human nature at play, that this is about preserving their authority, about craving a kind of respect, that there's a kind of anger, even addiction, as Eric Young puts it. What do you make of those components to this?
These are, I mean, you know, I'm those gentlemen are very studied in their opinions, and I don't disagree with them. What I look at is we are dealing with human beings. Human beings are emotional creatures. We our emotions go up, adrenaline goes up, we challenge each other, things happen. In police work, look, we respond on thousands, hundreds of thousands of calls a year. We do a great job 99.9% of the time. I mean, they don't and you need to realize that when we go on these calls, they're not calling us to the best day they've ever had in their life.
Right.
These are domestic violences. Yeah. These are horrific scenes of crimes. And we take chaos and we try to bring it down into calm, reasonable actions. We train very hard on that. I mean, they talked about anger management, mm-hmm. verbal judo.
Mm-hmm.
We train verbal judo in our police department. We have for 20-something years. I learned it when I hired on. We also do blue courage training. We just started into that, which is really – it takes officers back to why they became a police officer, to protect and serve, the nobility of police work. We have started into Arbinger training.
Hmm.
Arbinger training basically takes you to a point where you start looking at people as people, not as objects. A lot of time in this job, we see you know people as an object. You're the victim. You're the perpetrator. You're a witness. And people have, you know, they have wishes, they have dreams, all these things are happening. And when we're trying to go through this, we need to put those things into perspective. We also have done, they talked about, we've implemented a code called 909. Code 909. Because if you and I go on a call, mm-hmm. Somebody may be pushing your buttons. I mean, we always send two officers. One's the initial, one's a backup.
Right.
I think you saw that up at the University of Utah.
Yep.
When somebody is pushing your buttons and getting the best of you,
yeah.
or it's escalating to a point where you're feeling yourself, your anxiety's coming up, there is...
You could see that, by
yeah.
the way, in this video.
Yeah. So there's in our training, it's okay to grab somebody by the shoulder and say, look, I've got this.
Yeah.
Step away.
Yeah.
And it doesn't – rank doesn't matter. It's whoever has the calmest head in this situation. And we train that.
So what happened? You train it. Didn't work, or at least in that circumstance. Are you saying that, look, guys, this is just going to happen every once in a while. We don't have a systemic problem. Is that what you're saying?
I don't think we have a systemic problem. I think this is an outlier of outliers. This is an anomaly. Look.
That went viral.
It did. Yeah.
Throughout the world.
It did. And,
yeah.
Yeah. And we've been under the microscope. And look, I'm not shying away from what happened. And what this police department has done. What I'm saying is, look, that is not who we are. The officers that serve every day, I wish I could take the videotape, the hundreds of hours, because we all have cameras,
yeah.
and play for people. Look, here's a situation where these officers did heroic work to de-escalate the situation. In fact, we have been, we've worked very hard on de-escalation. We've one of the other stories that kind of went viral is that for a major city, we hadn't had an officer-involved shooting for 18 months. That's amazing. I don't think anybody could hold a record to that. Now, unfortunately, those things happen, and we've had a couple shootings since, but there's something there. We're
yeah.
doing very good work on the street.
How much should citizens be involved in oversight? I mean, I know that I can't tell. I'm wondering if law enforcement just sees that as, oh, you guys let us do our jobs and leave us alone. Or you think that – I mean, Norm Stamper says it's really crucial. What do you think?
I think it is.
Yeah.
I do. I mean, in fact, right after the Abdi Muhammad shooting, there was a group of people. There were folks from Utahns Against Police Brutality, Black Lives Matter, different groups that were screaming and protesting in the street. And I reached out to them and I said, folks, you want change. Let's sit down face to face and talk through this. And you know what? They did. And the group was – we call them – I mean, in police work, we have acronyms for everything.
Right.
And they're called CAG, but they're the community activist group. And we have – and since that shooting, we have had meetings with them every 2 weeks. We sit down and we talk about these hard issues. We had a meeting last night where we talked through some very hard issues. They voice their opinions, and they're not happy. And then we listen, and then we come back and say, so there's an education on both sides. And look, they have said some very important things that we have implemented into our police department. On the other hand, we've been able to say, look, this is why we do these things. And they go, well, that makes sense. We didn't know.
Yeah. Nurse Wobbles and her attorney have said that the reason they released that body cam video of the event was because the police were not taking things seriously. Would you have done the things you're doing now if that video had not gone viral and created such a response, do you think?
Well, I don't know if I'd be here talking to you today, but I'm glad I am. I really am,
yeah.
seriously. And I want to get out in front of this right now and tell people, look, give us the time to run the process.
But do you agree with her that maybe we didn't respond in the way we should have or took it as seriously? Or do you disagree with them?
No, I don't. Here's the thing. We have met with Alex Wobbles and her attorney,
yeah.
and I know they've been very appreciative of the work that we have done, the Salt Lake City Police Department.
I think she said as much.
Yeah, she did.
Way.
She acknowledged that.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, right out of the shoot, we opened up an internal affairs investigation. We went up the day after and met with the CEO, the COO, the nurses management team, press, I mean, their PR people, their attorneys, everybody, to talk about how do we prevent and repair this situation. This should not ever happen again. We should not walk into an emergency room and confront a nurse or any medical provider with this type of request or this type of dialogue to say we need blood. Nurses have to do their work. They're saving people's lives. Every minute they're engaging us in conversation is time away from their patients. This shouldn't have happened like this.
Officials with the University Hospital have now changed their policy, though, and nurses can no longer interact with the police. They have to interact with a supervisor. I mean, is that a good thing?
No, but now there's been a lot of discussion. We've had discussion with them about policy this week. Chief Brophy,
so they're rethinking that, you think?
Yeah. No. Chief Brophy put out a kind of an interim.
Explain who that's. Dale Brophy.
Dale Brophy is the chief of police up at the University of Utah.
Right.
He put out an interim policy because he's out of town. We had conversation with the University of Utah executives yesterday, and I think we've reached a very good policy. Look, when we go to the hospital, if we need blood, we shouldn't be talking to a charge nurse. There's a better process. But we go to the hospital for all kinds of investigations, CODAR kits, rape investigations, things where we need to talk to people. And so I don't think that's the issue. It's this blood draw and some of these things that Nurse Wubbles was not the person we needed to engage that day.
Detective Payne was a part-time paramedic with Gold Cross Ambulance, and after the arrest, he says in that video that he's going to take transients to the University of Utah Hospital, and this is how he puts it, take the good patients elsewhere. This may be part of the process that you can't talk about, but what did you make about the kind of retribution here? This does not put him in a good light, and it's on video.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've heard mention of those conversations. And again, all these conversations, the peripheral conversations, the entire – this whole thing in its entirety will be reviewed by myself with a fine-tooth comb, and it won't go – I will turn over every stone on this investigation.
I guess the question then is, Chief, how do you fix something like this? There's been a change in – well, give me a sense of this. I want to come up to date. I mean, there was talk about changing the policy for blood draws. Mm-hmm. There's talk about additional training. I did at least hear that. But then I'm also hearing you say, I don't think there's a systemic problem. So how are you thinking about what – like, it sounds like you're saying this is an outlier. I think we're covered. I think we're fine. So it doesn't sound like you're really going to do anything about this particular case.
Oh, no.
Am I wrong?
No. I mean, don't make no mistake on that. We are going to do a lot. We've changed our internal policy. When you go to the hospital, there's basically two things that you will do in a blood draw. If you have consent and you can facilitate that through a hospital administrator, we will get it. Or if you have a probable cause warrant in hand. Those two things.
Yeah,
that's a big difference. We won't be walking in and confronting some, a nurse, a charge nurse, or anybody like that. There's a better way to do that. We also have, through conversations with the hospital and Chief Brophy, talked about what we can do when we respond to the hospital for any type of thing.
Yeah.
But we've taken it even farther. We're reaching out to Shriners, LDS Hospital. Shriners, LDS, Salt Lake Regional.
Right.
I would like to take this policy and how we interact with people valley-wide through the Valley Police Association so that chiefs all together in this valley come together and talk about there's a better way to respond to these hospitals and do that. I know in talking with Mayor Biskupski, she would like to take it either statewide or even a national process. So, look, we're doing a lot. We will continue. These aren't one and done. You have to continue to train on these things and refine your skills, your communication skills. So we implement parts of these training every year in the training that we give our officers. So, I mean, if you stop training, if you think you've got it all figured out, you're heading in a bad direction.
Right. What did you make of the idea in some of the research that suggests it's kind of a male thing, that there's this serotonin and testosterone and all this kind of brew of brain chemistry going into play that escalates things, that there's such a powerful biological thing going on that it's hard for officers at the moment?
It sounds like excuses to me.
Really?
It really does. I mean, I look at that as an excuse. I mean, our officers have to be better than that. That you can't walk in and say, well, I lost control because of my serotonin or my testosterone is high that day. You can't do that. You have to perform the very best every time. Sometimes situations don't go the way we like. But look, I've said many times, the way you train on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday is how you play the game on Saturday. And by the way, I know the Utah, they're trained very well.
Yes, they
for
are.
For the big game tomorrow. But look, our department is very well trained, and I've said this so many times. We have great officers the women and men who serve this city do it well. And I want that message to resonate through this city that this is an outlier. Look, I apologize for this situation. If I could go back in time and make it not happen, I would. But we will do better. If we've made mistakes, we will fix them. And we will be a better police department because of this.
What's the proper punishment for Detective Payne? Of course, you're hearing those that say he needs to be fired, a lot of calls for him to being fired. Is that an overreaction? And should there even be a criminal investigation?
I think there are three investigations going on right now.
Yeah.
I don't think people realize that. Our internal process through internal affairs, the Citizen Review Board has an independent review, and then District Attorney Sim Gill is looking into the criminal aspects. Look, in this situation, I think we need to focus as many lenses on this thing so that at the end of the day, we have the right call, that people know that we've done our due diligence to make sure this situation has been vetted and we know what happened, why it happened, but most importantly, to prevent it from ever happening again.
But you don't want to say, I think.
Yeah, I can't really say, Doug, I'm sorry.
I get it. I understand.
Yeah, I have to reserve my comments on that.
Of course. Let me ask you this finally. How much damage do you think has been done to the reputation of the police department and to the general sense of respect that's supposed to exist between citizen law enforcement by this?
Oh, it hurts.
Yeah.
It hurts. We got a black eye. But and that's what I think that's what hurts so bad is we've worked so hard for the last couple of years through our training and outreach and everything we've done to kind of take this on the chin. Look, we'll take it. We'll make it better. But it hurts. But that goes back to, again, I want to talk to, I mean, even to the officers and to the citizens. This is not who we are. Give us a chance. We'll make it better. And you'll see who we really are.
Salt Lake City Police Chief Mike Brown. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Doug.
For joining us. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Timothy Slover, technical direction today. Program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.